And in a moment, a very special guest, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, former Apollo 14 astronaut on Coast to Coast AM. Retired Navy Captain Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon. His academic background includes a Bachelor of Science in Industrial Management from Carnegie Mellon University, a Bachelor of Science from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, and a Doctor of Science in Aeronautics and Astronautics from MIT. After retiring from the Navy in 1972, Dr. Mitchell founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences to sponsor research into the nature of consciousness as it relates to cosmology. In 1984, he was a co-founder of the Association of Space Explorers, an international association of those who have experienced space travel. He is also the author of Psychic Exploration, The Way of the Explorer, The View from Space DVD. Dr. Mitchell has spent the last 30 years studying human consciousness and psychic and paranormal phenomena and the search of a common ground between science and spirit. And I just wanted to get him started early, so he's up with us now on Coast to Coast, Dr. Mitchell. Edgar, always a pleasure, my friend. How are you?
Thank you, George. Nice to be with you this morning.
Likewise, likewise. You've been busy lately since we last talked some time ago.
I stayed pretty busy and a lot going on.
Well, I had an opportunity to meet Buzz Aldrin. I was on Larry King's show several weeks ago, and what a delightful guy. He's as tough now as he probably was then, Edgar.
Well, he's Buzz, all right.
He is. Does not believe in extraterrestrials. At all. Did you ever talk with him about that?
Just briefly. I've talked with all the fellows about what they saw in space, but none of us have seen a first-hand experience, at least through the Apollo program. Nothing in space that was not subsequently validated or understood.
Edgar, though, we're going to talk about a lot of your new work tonight. I wanted to just review a little bit Apollo 14 astronaut, some incredible things. I get upset sometimes when people claim that we did not go to the moon. Do you get that much, Edgar, whenever you're out or speaking? Do people actually ask you?
Well, it comes up occasionally, but I point out also, and it's good to point out here, there's over 6.5 billion people on this Earth right now, and half of them weren't born when we went to the moon. So the younger group may properly have doubts because they weren't there to listen to all of it. My standard answer when people bring it up, which isn't very often, you really think the Soviets would have let us get away with this? Because it was a race to the moon, and we won, but and the Soviets knew exactly what we were doing all the time. They simply wouldn't have let it be a hoax and not blow the whistle. So it's really nonsensical. And the evidence is overwhelming that we did just what we said we did. And the equipment's still there, and the laser reflectors are still there. You can do it any day of the week if you have the right laser and astronomy and the telescope. You can confirm exactly where it is. So all the evidence is there. You just have to look.
Are you disappointed that we didn't continue the manned moon missions?
As a scientist, yes. None of the scientists thought that we were ready to quit because we just got started. But the public was saying, oh, ho-hum, been there, done that, and we did what John Kennedy wanted to do, so what's new? That's kind of a short-sighted view, unfortunately, but that's what it is.
You know, 3 years ago when you were last on the program, we talked about the possibilities of extraterrestrial life, and I share your views at that time. Of course, we talked about the possibility of visitation and what had happened on this planet a long time ago. Do you still believe that? You haven't changed your mind that you believe that we have been visited?
Oh, no. The evidence is very, very strong. My disclaimer is I have no first-hand experience. All of my experience comes from what I call the old-timers who were around before looking at these things before I was and before the modern period. And I had the good fortune to be briefed by some of them. Most of them, nearly all of them, as far as I know now, deceased. But and I furthermore had it confirmed for me by a very high-level officer that was involved. So all I can say is I have no firsthand experience, but yes, the evidence is overwhelming as far as I'm concerned that we have been visited.
Edgar, when Neil Armstrong and Buzz were on the moon with Apollo 11, there are some who have always said that they saw craft on the moon, extraterrestrial craft. Of course, Buzz denies it. Neil, of course, really has never talked about that at all, doesn't talk much about anything, really. He's not as available as other astronauts have been. Did you ever hear any scuttlebutt about that at all?
Well, of course, you hear the scuttlebutt about it, but it's not from our guys. It's manufactured out in the great unwashed public out there.
What about structures on the moon? Nothing like that.
I can speak directly to that because there was a claim that the structures were mirrored in my visor.
Okay, so
it's my visor and Alan Bean's visor, and that simply is not true.
So at least in the areas that our astronauts landed, we're talking about it was just the old moon.
That is exactly right. I do not doubt or will not deny that the possibility exists that there might be alien bases at some point put on the moon. But as far as I can tell from everything I've seen, that is not true. And we don't have the evidence of it if it's true.
You know, Edgar, I always thought also it could be possible that humankind lived millions and millions of years ago, in that if there was ever any evidence on the moon of something past, it might have been us, that we might have visited the moon a long, long time ago. Did you ever think about that?
Well, I've thought about that. I don't find that very credible or appealing. I think we do have a pretty good understanding of our past history. Now, we could be wrong. There's a lot of other things are wrong, too, about our knowledge base. But I don't think that was wrong.
When you and I first talked, I was doing my local show in St. Louis. Your book, The Way of the Explorer, had just come out. An incredible story of how you started to experiment with the mind. Tell us a little bit about that and what pushed you in that direction. So much more than your journey now, I think, is possibly even more exciting than even when you went to the moon.
Well, thank you. What got me started was just reading science literature, and particularly the work of the early parapsychologists who did experiments and insisted that they were finding a phenomenon that we couldn't explain, what we now call our intuitive level, and which, by the way, just to set the record straight, seems pretty well explained and within quantum physics and modern understanding of the structure. But at that time, it certainly was not. And the intrigue for me was that if these guys are right, if the experimental evidence is correct and is replicated, then we in science are absolutely wrong in insisting that there's no such thing. And because based upon Newtonian physics, you don't have an explanation for it. Well, that's exactly true. In Newtonian physics, you don't have an explanation for it. But in quantum physics, we do. And the modern evidence is overwhelming. There's not any question that anybody wants to look and study the evidence as to what the answer is.
In the years that have come and gone, have we found more scientific proof of what you've been talking about for so long?
Well, it's not. The answer is more. Yes. If you use the probability approach, statistical approach, which is used in all science about things, the probabilities are completely off the chart that the experiments show precisely what we say they show. And so most of us don't waste any time with that anymore, trying to prove the existence of the intuitive or quantum faculty. It's there. But understanding all of the mechanizations and how brain-mind works in this area, that's the new area. And the neurophysiologists are in on it now. We're making a great deal of headway. I mean, it's no longer for anyone that's really studied and wants to look at the film. It's not a mystery anymore. It's just we don't know all the details.
You developed a model years ago called the dyadic model of human consciousness. Has that model stayed the same? Has it changed at all?
Yes. It's stayed the same. It's correct. Like I say, it's not complete in that we don't have all the answers, but it is correct as far as it goes. And simply stated for our listeners, which is not, it's not hard to state it, begin just with the notion that energy and matter is not quite enough to explain our existence and how we know about it. That you have to have a basic mechanism in physics that explains information. Now, information theory has grown up here in the last few years to become quite an important part of the way we look at nature. And basic information theory, although it began in the late 40s, has matured, and we now understand quantum information, which we did not at that point in time. Go ahead.
Understand you're on a wonderful documentary with directed and produced by Ron Howard. And
you're talking about this new one, The Shadow of the Moon?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ron's involved with that. And it's just premiered in New York. It premiered last week, last Friday. My voice is starting to crack on me here, George. Sorry.
Hold on, Edgar. You've got 2.5 hours to go.
A cup of tea here.
That's right. You know what? I always find that I've got a little tea. I put some honey in it right before I go on the air all the time, and it just kind of soothes you.
It smooths the throat.
Yeah. Yeah,
right.
It really can, and a little bit later on, we're going to be taking phone calls, so we'll give you a little relief there.
Okay, good.
Ed Mitchell, Apollo14.com is Dr. Mitchell's website. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and I would invite all of you to go take a look at some of the incredible things he has done. You know, on this program, we have talked in the past about the institute that he founded called the Institute of Noetic Sciences that really dives into the nature of consciousness and how it relates to space. And we'll talk with him more about that. We'll also get into those views that Dr. Mitchell believes we have been visited by extraterrestrials, though, like he said, he doesn't have the firsthand eyewitness account himself. He believes in the people who have told him this. We'll talk about that. I don't know if he can reveal the names of everyone, but we'll see what he's got. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. You know, I was 20 years old, about ready in a few months after that to turn 21, when Apollo 14 with Dr. Mitchell and Alan Shepard, of course, being the first American to go into space, when they landed on the moon, 20 to 21 years old. And, you know, every time I talk with Dr. Edgar Mitchell, I still feel like a kid, even though I wasn't a kid at 20 years old, because of the wonders. You just sit back and imagine this, to be talking to someone who actually was on the moon. I mean, you look at the moon, the full moon we just had a few weeks ago. It's wondrous. It's the mysteries of this universe. I'm looking forward to this. And we'll talk a little bit more about extraterrestrial life. In the next hour, we'll get into his new work, The View from Space. Well, I might have a little surprise for you with Dr. Mitchell in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Edgar, was the heart thumping that February day in 1971 when you walked on the moon?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the medics told me it was. I was too busy doing other things to worry about it, but yes, they said so.
Did you and Alan have any problems or technical problems while you were there?
Any kind of what problems?
Technical problems at all? Any potential problems when you were on the moon?
Not that I'm aware of.
Good, good. Well, obviously you're back, so we don't have to worry about that. But
right.
I guess Buzz was talking about how he had to use his pen to jerry-rig a switch in order to get the capsule, his limb, I guess, back off the face of the moon.
We all had little problems from time to time, of course. If you're talking about equipment failures, yes, every mission had those. We did too, but thanks to a well-trained team, both on the ground and in the spacecraft, we were able to get around all of those.
Okay, so here we are in that case, 36 years later when you were on the moon. What do you think our technology today would give us in terms of capability if we went back to the moon within 10 years?
Well, we would have, we can do anything we really want to do. The technology, the progress of technology is utterly amazing. I'd like to tell a little story if you give me
sure.
a minute here to help put this in perspective with our, with my audiences and our viewers. I tell the story that my great-grandparents came across from Georgia after our Civil War in the 1870s, covered wagon, pulled by horses, a few head of cattle to start a herd and a new life in Texas. Railroads weren't complete across the South and the West. Automobiles hadn't been invented. The electric light bulb hadn't been invented. My father was born shortly after the Wright brothers made their first flight, and I went to the moon. From covered wagons to going to the moon in less than 100 years. Now, given the history of humankind and what we know about our past and clear back to, you know, walking on foot, taming camels and horses and all of that, and the explosion of new ideas, new technology that took place, what we call the modern period, from the end of our Civil War in the 1860s, to going to the moon, and it hadn't abated yet. We're on an exponential growth curve, an explosive growth in science and technology and knowledge.
And you can imagine, Edgar, a civilization then, somewhere out there in the universe, that is ahead of us, assuming the same kind of growth curve,
of course,
by, let's say, a million years.
Of course. And if our understanding of the universe is at all even close to being accurate, and there's a lot of questions about our understanding of it. Give me.
Sure.
There are millions and billions of galaxies and planets and galaxy clusters, star systems. The idea that we're alone in the universe is, once we now start to understand a little bit about it, is utterly absurd. We're not the youngest by any means, probably, nor certainly are we the oldest civilization around. There have got to be billions of them out there. It's just a long ways out there, and we've only gone a few miles off our own planet, not to mention outside of our solar system, which we will have the science and technology to do if we pursue it, I believe, by the end of the century we're in, provided we don't blow ourselves up with stupidities in the process.
Oh, that's so true, Edgar, so true indeed. Do you recall the case in the 1960s of Barney and Betty Hill, the abduction case?
I've read that case, yes. I'm aware of it. I have not read about it in many years now, but yes, I'm aware of that and was aware of it when I was looking into these things quite a few years ago.
When you were a youngster growing up, were you interested in this entire field of consciousness and the possibility of extraterrestrial life out there?
Well, since I grew up in Roswell, or in the vicinity of Roswell, Mexico, it was hard to escape it. But however, the so-called Roswell incident did not take place until 1947, and I was a senior in high school at that point. As a matter of fact, in 1947, I was a senior in high school. And the ranch where presumably this all occurred, my grandfather was a cattleman and traded cattle. And we knew the ranchers in that area. Of course, the lore around Roswell from the insiders and the old, what I call the old-timers, was prevalent everywhere. But then when the Air Force shut it all up and said, no, it was a weather balloon, it wasn't really what we thought it was, there were some of us said, that's kind of crazy. No, it's not that. However, it kind of went away for a long, long time. But back in the recesses of your mind, you remember what all went on back in those days.
At what point in your adult life, and let's say your professional science life, your professional life as an astronaut. At what point, or who was it, if you can reveal it to us tonight, or what was the case where somebody started talking to you that convinced you that we had been visited by extraterrestrials on this planet? What happened?
Well, it wasn't just any one person. It was the accumulation of evidence of people. And then some of the Roswell people, some of the military people, certainly Wernher von Braun, whom I knew quite well, presumably, and according to the stories and what he's told to me also, was supportive. And that the paperclip people from Germany were at Fort Bliss at the time of all this happened. And I became very close to Wernher. And he dropped a few hints. He didn't discuss it with me at great depth, but we did become close enough that he didn't hold it back, really.
You were pretty...
At that point that I really knew from multiple sources saying the same thing, that we didn't have it, that it was all true. Or at least, maybe not all the details. There were differences in details, but by and large, the phenomenon itself was correct.
Of course, one of the main reasons we were able to get to the moon with those Saturn rockets pushing you all up there was because of Dr. Wernher von Braun.
He and many of his colleagues have been given a pretty bad rap over the years, but nevertheless, he was a wonderful man and a brilliant thinker, and his whole goal was to explore the universe, and rocket science was the beginning of it.
And so you are convinced that he believed that we have been visited?
Question. Yeah, no question.
My gosh.
Belief. Now, that doesn't mean that he went around talking about it all the time, but he was apparently there and asked to investigate at that first incident because of his rocketry knowledge.
Were we ever able, Edgar, to reverse engineer alien technology?
Oh, I'm sure that has happened to a point. I am not privy to the inner workings of the group that still controls all of that, but they do exist, and it's still the same group, just different names, than was managing it from that time forward, set up by President Truman.
Do most astronauts believe we've been visited?
I can't answer that question. I only know that people that from my group well, and there's some that do not.
Some do not, but some do?
Yeah.
And we know the late Gordon Cooper, who was a stage before you, he was a believer.
Well, yes, Gordon, there were quite a few of the fellows had experiences in their Air Force career or military career, their flight career, before the astronaut program that had experiences that where they were vectored to chase what was thought to be a UFO and try to do so and couldn't get close and things like that. There's quite a few fellows who had that type of experience.
Edgar, did you ever hear the story of Jackie Gleason and his obsession with extraterrestrials and that?
Of who, please?
The comedian Jackie Gleason.
I heard a little bit about that, and I knew Jackie since I lived here in South Florida, and he did too.
Yes.
I met with him a couple of times, but I never really got into the depth of that with him, no.
Okay, because the story goes, while he was down there living in Florida, then president, or perhaps he was ready to leave office, Richard Nixon, took Jackie Gleason to Homestead Air Force Base and showed him an extraterrestrial. And apparently, Jackie Gleason was never the same after that.
Well, I don't know that that really was true, but because I don't know that Homestead Air Force Base really entered into it. I heard that story periphery. Now that you remind me of it, I have no way of assessing it.
Do you believe that these visitations have been ongoing on this planet, maybe since the beginning of mankind, and they continue to this day?
Well, they apparently have been going on for quite some lengthy period. There is even in some of the ancient paintings of some of our masters, there is a picture of what appears to be, looked like what we would consider a UFO, in a painting dating back to the 16th century or so. But, you know, that's all circumstantial evidence. It doesn't really prove to us, but it's very interesting.
Assuming they've been here, have you ever tried to think of what form of propulsion they would use to get here?
Yes, trying to understand the propulsion system has certainly been very interesting, very important. A lot of people have worked on it. And if indeed the back engineering that you mentioned earlier has taken place at all, which I think it has, there may very well be people, but they're keeping it to themselves, and it's being closely contained, having deciphered exactly how the propulsion systems work. I don't personally know them, and I would like to know, but I'm not a part of the group that's delved into that.
Did you ever know the late Colonel Philip Corso, by any chance?
I did have the privilege of relating to him shortly before he passed away, and read his books, and when I was with a group called the Scientific Advisory Committee for the National Institute of Discovery Science, we were in contact with Corso. And his complaint was, of course, that his book, which was very revealing, also got compromised in the last edition. And he was quite upset that some things had got added into it that were not accurate. And I don't really know the details of that story either, but I know there was quite a flap about it just after his death.
But the pattern, Edgar, and this is what I find to be remarkable, shows clearly that people with responsibility, people with the know-how, have either witnessed firsthand or have firsthand knowledge, like you, of visitations. And I look at the case of the late Lieutenant Walter Haut, who was at Roswell, who put out that initial news release.
Absolutely.
Of course. And, you know, he leaves an affidavit, signs it, he dies, but the affidavit clearly spells out that he said they were crashed saucers, and I saw these bodies. And it's an amazing story.
Well, we can understand, you can understand a little bit the background here, at least as I understand it. It was the fact that, were that to be true, the military at that point in time realized they had no defenses for it and didn't want to admit to the people that if this was a hostile civilization, we were in danger. And remember, this was right after World War II. The Air Force had just been formed from the Army Air Corps. The OSS had been disbanded, later to be replaced by the CIA. So there was a considerable confusion, to you quote the phrase, who's on first, back at that period, in both aviation circles and intelligence circles. And the fear factor that grew out of that, of not being able to protect and defend the nation from this threat, if it were real, was overwhelming. Now, what happened, of course, was the National Security Act of 1947 got passed, which really put in place the autonomy of the committee of the system that was trying to manage this. And that hasn't gone away. That is still in place, although in different names. And this, some would call it a cabal, have absolutely refused to come out of the woodwork, refused to acknowledge, but they control anything and everything related to the follow-on of that technology.
Do you think some past presidents, maybe even current presidents, are left in the dark about some of this?
I think it has been a pattern since Eisenhower, who in his final speech reminded us and warned us of the military-industrial complex, and that's what he was talking about, this particular group, I believe. And I think John F. Kennedy knew some. The evidence is he knew a little bit, but he was excluded also, and virtually every president after that has may have had a little bit of knowledge, but was not fully read into the system. That's the state of my knowledge of it.
Do you think, Edgar, I'm going to jump on the Mars for just a moment. We're going to hit the break soon, and we're going to come back and talk about the view from space.
Okay.
Do you think that Mars might have been inhabited at one point? I mean, did the same people who talked to you about extraterrestrial visitations here, did anybody ever talk with you about what might have happened on that planet?
Well, there's a lot of speculation, but... And certainly it's possible, but we don't really have any firm evidence of that. And Mars isn't really very habitable because of the...
Not anymore.
Yeah. Well, certainly it might have been a bit warmer in earlier days, but it's being twice as far away from the sun as the Earth is, it's pretty chilly there most of the time.
Well, I got to tell you, I am so glad you've been able to come on the program tonight, and we'll keep you for the next 2 hours as long as that voice holds up. How you doing, okay?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Okay. Well, our very special guest, of course, is Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And his website, first of all, is edmitchellapollo14.com. Some of his works, and they are all well worth grabbing. And so take a look at it, The Way of the Explorer, which was the first book that he wrote that I really, really just dived into, so much so when I was doing my local show at KTRS in St. Louis back some time ago. Gosh, seems so long ago. I sat down with my producers and said, please get him on the program. And he's been on many shows now, and always a wonderful guest. And we'll be talking about the view from space and really get into the consciousness end of what this is all about. Because Dr. Mitchell has indeed changed his entire career into this direction. So we'll be back with Dr. Edgar Mitchell. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And in a moment, he'll be joined by a mutual friend of both of ours on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with, of course, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And Edgar, I remember in St. Louis when you were telling me an incredible story of your work about a tie clasp that you had lost when you were meeting your dear friend Uri Geller. So we're going live to England right now, and we're going to bring Uri in for the next half hour with you. Uri, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much. It's such a pleasure to be on with my great friend, Ed Mitchell. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Hello, Uri. How are you?
There you
go.
Okay. When's the last time you two either chatted with each other or saw each other, Uri?
Well, I am in touch with Ed, I would say, all the time. I just saw his picture in USA Today just a few days ago. And I was on an airplane, and I pulled out my BlackBerry and emailed him, hey, Ed, I just saw your picture. And it took Ed about a day and a half to email me back, but it did.
And Uri, let me also just say happy Rosh Hashanah to you, my friend. And Edgar, let's let you relate first the story, this incredible story of the tie clasp, and then we'll get Uri to mention his role in this. It's an incredible story.
Okay. Well, certainly, very briefly, it was when we were doing work at Stanford Research Institute, now called SRI International, and testing, trying to show what Uri was able to do with his newfound to us capabilities that we hadn't seen before. And we were doing all sorts of things in psychokinesis and teleportation and such research. And... I'll have to admit, there were times when I'd say, Uri, come on, let's focus on the experiment now. And anyhow, the story came up about my camera on the moon. And my story of this, Uri can chime in here. My story was, I said, Uri, if you're going to teleportation, there's a camera I left on the moon that has a serial number on it. NASA knows about it. Bring that back, and you'll really be a famous guy. Well, of course, what I didn't tell him, it was anchored to the little cart that we used to pull it around. So it weighed a couple hundred pounds. It's a little difficult to get back. Anyhow, And the offshot of that was the next day we were in the cafeteria at SRI and having lunch, and all of us sitting around the table. And I kind of have a feeling that Uri's mind was going on Ed Mitchell's lost camera, how can I get that back, and et cetera, et cetera. But what happened instead was, as we finished our lunch, Uri asked for some iced cream. And I had the waitress, we were sitting right next together, had the waitress bring a dish of ice cream. Uri took a couple of bites out of this goblet that had the ice cream in it, and cried out in pain. Blood came to his lips, and he took a chunk of ice cream out of his mouth, and I washed it off in a spoon in my glass, and discovered it was an emblem that looked like a hunting arrow, a three-pluted hunting arrow with a ram's head on it. And I held this up to the crowd and said, "Gentlemen, look at this." They said, "What is it?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, but it looks like the emblem on a tie pin that I had that was in a jewel box that I lost a couple of years ago before Uri and I ever met." And so the scientists and the mathematicians started computing the probability that something looking like Ed Mitchell's tie pins would show up in Uri Geller's ice cream while we were doing experiments in psychokinesis. Ha, ha, ha. So I put it in my pocket, and we went back to the lab to start the afternoon's work. And I went into the inner lab to set up the afternoon, and Uri helped put off a number of the other people, including Shippy, and five or six people were standing in the outer room. And all of a sudden, I heard a plink, something hitting a tile floor outside, and looked out just in time to see Dr. Puthoff pick up something off the floor. And then I said, "What is that?" And he said, "Well, here it is." He handed it to me. And I said, "Well, that's the tie bar that this ram's head emblem goes on." And so, ha-ha, what's the probability of two things
exactly
showing up in all of this? So back to work again. Puthoff and I went on to the inner lab and started to work with Uri and the rest still standing outside. With just the two of us in the room, suddenly a third object just seemed to drop to the floor. I reached down and picked it up, and it just seemed to come out of nowhere. I reached down and picked it up, and Puthoff said to me, "What is that?" And I said, "Well, it is a pearl stick pin with a silver shank and a brass clutch back on it." And he said, "What's that mean?" I said, "Well, I had a silver... rather a pearl stick pin with a silver shank and a silver clutch back that my brother had sent me from Japan when he was in duty over there a few years ago. And I had lost the silver clutch back on it and put a brass clutch back from my Navy wings on it. And it was in the same jewel box that I lost with these other two objects." So here we had three objects that Uri and his rambling mind had suddenly picked up in cyberspace somewhere and presented them to us without anybody touching it. It just appeared in these things. So it's quite a crazy story. It's not good science, but it sure is awfully good anecdotal.
It's a great radio story.
Right, and I still have those in my safe here 30-some years later.
Well, Uri, what's your take on this story? What happened?
Well, you know, I wish I knew the technicality of what happens when a teleportation occurs. I simply can't explain it. I know that it happened. It blew my mind because you don't find metallic objects in your ice cream, do you?
Not normally.
And, and what an odd object it was. I had no idea that this belonged to Ed. The first thought that came to my mind was that, you know, someone at the factory or wherever they manufactured the ice cream, something fell into the ice cream. But when Ed said, "Hey, this is mine," you know, I just realized that yes, there was a teleportation. It came from somewhere. You know, the object that Ed lost, he lost it, like he said, 2 or 3 years before he ever met me. And I realized that there was something out there telling me that, hey, Uri, forget bringing the camera back. This is what's going to happen. And when the whole typing came together, it led me to believe that there is either a thinking entity behind this phenomena, or your mind can assemble certain things from the past, and in such an order that is just so extraordinary, it is so astonishing. I had similar occurrences happen to me in the past, but it certainly doesn't happen every day. And I tell this story, you know, to people, and they look at me and they say, yeah, sure, come on, this never happened. This is a great story, but it's made up, isn't it? And no, it's not made up. It really, really happened, and you'll have to believe us. Definitely, you'll have to believe Ed. But isn't it mind-blowing? I mean, I'm sure that all your listeners now, at least whoever is not skeptical, says, you know, this is, wow, how can these things happen? But they do.
You know, Uri, I was in a conference just a few weeks ago in San Jose, and a woman came up to me and said, if you ever talk to Uri Geller again, thank him for starting my watch that hadn't started in 22 years.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should say this, but last night I came back from Germany. I was in Hanover and Hamburg and Berlin, and I was interviewed on a TV show, and I didn't want to do anything, but the host, the presenter, brought up an old show that I have done 35 years ago called Wim Tölke, where, of course, I would do my kind of famous feat of looking into the camera and asking people to get their broken watches, and I would say 1, 2, 3, work. And for many, many years, I always thought that it was my energy. But, of course, I was wrong. I'm only a catalyst when this happens. I'm an enabler, and I kind of influence the belief system of the people who are holding the broken watches. But to cut the long story short, you know, people tell me, well, Uri, you know, the cynics, they say, well, if you shake the watch or you warm the oil, it'll start working. Well, okay, I accept that. But what about the hundreds of emails and faxes I used to get, letters from people who tell me, Uri, I had a 100-year-old pocket watch, and of course it was broken, and I took it several times to a watchmaker, and the watchmaker would look at it, open it up, and say, hey, forget it. I will never be able to fix it because there's actually either a part missing or a broken part inside the pocket watch, and this factory doesn't even exist anymore. I can't fix it. I can't get the part to make the pocket watch start ticking. And it does. The watch starts ticking, and people are astonished and amazed. So am I. Because to this day, after 55 years doing this, demonstrating this ability, I have absolutely no scientific or rational explanation how the watch starts and comes alive. And the only explanation I have, that there must be some type of a materialization or teleportation of the broken part that comes into the watch, fixes the watch, and it comes alive.
Or you have some ability, Uri, to just amass incredible energy around this watch, and that somehow is able to overtake everything.
Well,
this is Edgar. The one thing that we really have not been able to model within science very well is precisely this psychokinetic phenomenon of organizing matter in this way. The rest of the so-called paranormal stuff, and I don't even use that word anymore, paranormal, it's all normal stuff, is largely explainable by within the quantum mechanical framework. But this one still remains elusive. I'll have to admit that.
Uri, what's going on with the Criss Angel show with you and trying to find the future mentalists?
Yes, this is a great series on NBC starting on the 17th of October. You know, again, I get a lot of emails from people who ask me, hey, Uri, you know, how come you're lining yourself up with Criss Angel, who is a magician? Well, my answer to that is very simple. The series is really about finding a great performer. When I did the series in Israel just under a year ago, we didn't realize that it was going to be such a great hit. It got 50% of the market share. It broke all historical rating records. And when it was snapped up, the format was snapped up by many, many different countries around the world. I made it clear, and the first thing that I say on the stage when I walk out, the host, the presenter, usually asks me, hey, Uri, what is this? Is this these guys have paranormal powers? What are they? Are they illusionists? Are they mentalists? Are they psychological manipulators? And my answer is immediate. I say, I don't care what they are and how they do it. What I do care about is the most mesmerizing, amazing, mind-blowing performance. So this is what the show is about. We're looking for the great, the next great mentalist in the United States. So I'm very, very thrilled because, let's face it, I've been around, as I said before, for a long time. And for something like this to happen at this stage in my life is just wonderful. So it's NBC, October the 17th. Don't miss the show because it's going to be mind-blowing.
Well, it's going to be exciting. We've got to get you back on Coast to Coast right before that program again, Uri. Okay?
Thank you. And let me just say that Criss Angel is just such a great guy, and his skills and talents are amazing. You know, I've seen some of his videos on YouTube, and, you know, I just don't know how he does it.
I'm not sure he's human, right? I'm not sure he's human. There's something else there, you know?
Well, I just spent some time in the desert with him outside Los Angeles just a week ago because we were shooting the promo for NBC. And the same thought went through my mind, too.
Edgar, I'm sure you've seen some of Criss Angel's work.
No, I haven't.
Oh, you haven't? Okay, we've got to get him a tape, Uri, of some of the things that Criss Angel has done and some of the things you've done, of course, on this program once you two get into it. But again, a lot of it, Edgar, is what you've been looking into over all these years, and that is the ability of the mind to do these incredible things.
Yes, quite true.
How does the mind become so powerful even without the use of the brain?
Well, you're asking a good question, and those are questions right at the very heart of the science intrigue at this moment, is to understand these issues, and very frankly, we don't.
And it goes on for... And Uri, I am sure even you too, with the years of experience that you've had and the many times you and I have talked, the answer is difficult to find, isn't it?
Well, I have to go back to Albert Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, that from one side we look at objects and we think they're solid, but they're really not. They equal energy. If you put a microscope into your hand, you'll discover cells, molecules, atoms, and energy. I think everything moves. Everything has a vibration, a frequency. We live in an ocean of motion. And I think that some people can manipulate that energy and make these amazing, wonderful things that are still scientifically unexplained. My last words, I would like to really contribute to Ed, because, you know, whenever I'm asked, who is the one person that influenced your life, I always say Ed Mitchell. He's such a great individual. He's such an intellect. He's such a wise soul that I just... I'm like I used the word before, I'm mesmerized by his intelligence and his personality and his friendship. He's such a great guy. And
thank you,
God that I met Ed and he's been my mentor for all these years.
Well, I knew when we were going to have Edgar on this program, we had to have you on for at least a short segment, because you two are so important to this field, and I'm glad that we as humans have had this opportunity to have both of you on this walking this planet.
Thank you both, and thank you, Uri, for those nice words. And yes, we've been friends for all these years, trying to figure out how the world works in ways that's very strange.
Well, I can tell you this, that without you, I wouldn't be where I am, and maybe I wouldn't be who I am. So thank you, and George, thanks for getting us both together.
Thank you, Uri. You take care of yourself. We'll talk to you right before that NBC show hits the air in October. We'll be back again with Edgar Mitchell in just a moment, as we'll talk about his new work now, The View from Space, and what a view it is. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Edgar, let's talk a little bit about The View from Space. Tell me about that work.
Well, it actually is an old work that I recorded almost 30 years ago on audio tape, describing my experience of seeing Earth and the heavens and from space on the way back from the moon. And it got tucked away in a little audio cassette in my closet for many years. And my young son and his mother a few years ago, about 3 years ago, pulled it out and said this ought to be on modern media, and proceeded to make some CDs and DVDs from it, and they have been quite well received. Although I haven't entered a major marketing effort on them, they've been quite well received by those folks that had a chance to listen to them. That's kind of the story. And so they've made a set of CDs, and part of with three CDs, two of them are just a tour guide description of going to the moon. The third one is this View from Space, a message of peace that describes the epiphany, the insights that I had on coming back from the moon, and that's been quite well received. Thank you.
Edgar, as you look at worldwide events now, and everybody concerned about the event of possible nuclear holocaust, that the nukes could get in the hands of the wrong people, Do you hold, I guess, mankind in esteem to the point where you think we're going to get out of this, we're going to be okay, or do you think we're headed for disaster?
I think we have all the opportunity to learn that violence only begets more violence, and learn how to conduct our lives with each other and on this planet as a civilization, short of blowing ourselves up. It's very evident that we could do that with if we're not careful, and so far we haven't been very careful. Buckminster Fuller at the beginning of the space age pointed out back in the 50s that we're the crew of spaceship Earth, but we're a crew in mutiny, and how do you run a spaceship with a mutinous crew? And that's exactly what we are. We haven't learned to conquer and control our passions and our greed and our belief that our ego, that what we believe is the best thing and the only thing to believe. And so we're still a juvenile species. We're just barely out of the trees, frankly.
You know, they say we have free will. Something went wrong with us when we were created. I mean, we're too violent.
Well, exactly. But the point is, we can overcome that. This is exactly what my View from Space is about, is to having an insight, tuning in and recognizing we're all connected, that it's all part of the same thing. We're all one, as it were. And getting that message across, learning to live it, is what's vital here. Now, we see different examples of how this transformational idea takes place. And we see it in folks who've had near-death experiences, we so-called out-of-body experiences, these types of experiences where they suddenly see their life and themselves and civilization and humanity and nature with totally new eyes, and that's what we're talking about. And when that happens, we have the chance to transform ourselves and to learn to live in harmony and peace, which is the way we're designed to live. But we have to overcome our greed, our tendency towards self-service only and to start to look at the greater good. Now, all the great religions at their core teach this, but when they get politicized and enculturated and perverted by these human frailties, they seem to be something else. And so, in my opinion, the radicals in each tradition, it doesn't matter which tradition, the radicals in each tradition get off track and take us in a wrong direction. And that's what is happening right now.
I sometimes wonder that to our benefit, if we could only get visited publicly by extraterrestrials who would clearly, like the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, they land right there on the lawn in Washington, D.C., and an alien like Michael Rennie comes out with his robot, and all of a sudden, I would guess this planet may finally wake up. But I don't understand why that doesn't happen, because we believe we've been visited, but why don't they do that?
Well, I would say, frankly, George, that the problem is our problem, not theirs. They're waiting to see if we're going to mature and come to our senses and start to realize and develop our own destiny, as opposed to having to be saved, when we really have all the capability right within ourselves to do the right thing, and we just aren't doing it.
And that's a good point. We do want to be saved.
Yeah,
maybe that's not our mission. We've got to do this ourselves.
That is exactly my point, is that we are put together in such a way, that is what the, in my view, the view from space, the message of peace is all about, is it turns out that that was an experience of viewing the heavens and our earth and ourselves from a distance, and having the big picture perspective suddenly thrust upon you, and realizing that we don't have to be this way, that violence is simply not the right approach, that violence only begets more violence, and when we pursue that in that way, we're just wrong. We are not reaching our potential or our maturity, and we will surely destroy ourselves if we keep doing that. And it's not up to somebody to save us, it's for us to save ourselves.
Sure thing. From your entire trip during that period in 1971, from the Earth to the Moon, what for you, or maybe even back, what for you was the most inspiring, the most awe-inspiring?
Well, it was precisely what we were just talking about. It comes from seeing Earth from space and the heavens in that setting, to see the big picture. And just to make the long story short, after I came back, this was such a powerful experience when I recognized that the molecules of my body and the molecules in the spacecraft had been prototyped in some ancient generation of stars, and that it's really all one, that we're interconnected in this way, and accompanied by a realization that was ecstatic, blissful. And coming back, and eventually with the help of some scholars, finding that was description of that was not in our science literature, but in the ancient Sanskrit, and it's called samadhi. Salvakapa Samadhi, where you see things as separate as they really are, they're separate, but recognize underlying that is a connectedness. They're really all one. And learning to accept that, live that way, and get rid of our violent tendencies is what evolution and development is really all about.
Share with us, if you can, Edgar, because I'm getting chills just thinking of the question. And that is that very first moment that you were back on planet Earth and you looked up at a full moon. What did you feel?
Well, these types of experiences I'm just describing come back all the time. I have been able to recreate them, and it's a state of mind that you get into. And it's precisely why I founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences, to study consciousness, to study this phenomena, and to see what we humans can make out of it. What are we missing as we live our lives, as we evolve into hopefully something that will sustain ourselves on this planet instead of continuing to kill ourselves off with our stupidities.
I want to ask you this, and I want you to take this question with the incredible respect and friendship I have for you. But did you ever get, when you came back, so overcome with emotion that you broke down, that you cried because of this entire event?
Oh, well, I've done that many times when I get deep into that and study the condition of we humans and our short-sightedness. There's a lot of things that I can get me emotional in that regard, absolutely.
It's got to be a feeling that I envy you.
Well, I'm a very fortunate person to have had that experience and have the privilege of trying to tell people that experience and hopefully help move us a little bit more toward a sustainable future rather than one in which we self-destruct out of our stupidities.
I sometimes wonder if we as a planet need to take that big hit, whether it's an asteroid or some kind of nuclear holocaust, which will finally make us wake up, because we're just not doing what you've said we should do right now.
Well, that is true. We are not examining ourselves and going inside and discovering what is really inside ourselves. We're taking it all for granted and not asking the deep questions. And we're at a point in history where we have, since World War II, and we have created the nuclear weaponry technologies and worked very hard to avoid using them, but we haven't worked hard enough to avoid using them. We still dangle them out there like the sword of Damocles. If anybody messes with us, we'll use it on them. And we have to, as an entire Earth civilization, get beyond that. And right now, we're not close to that.
No, we're not. We're quite a ways from that, I think.
And the radical, religious fanatics, and
yep,
these are extremists on all the world, are the ones that are causing it. And we have to get past that. That brand of religion has become part of the problem, not the solution to anything. And we have to have solutions, not more problems.
You must be proud of the Institute.
My folks, I'm no longer involved in day-to-day activity. I sit on the board, of course, and I'm still mm-hmm. on the executive committee.
You're now the senior member of the Institute, huh?
Beg your pardon?
You're now the senior member of the Institute.
Well, yes. They are wonderful people. They're working very hard to help get this idea of transformation across and to do the science that, since science seems to be our truth table these days, when properly done, to use our science to demonstrate this and to understand exactly how these phenomena, and particularly the phenomenon that we were just talking about with Uri Geller a while ago, how does mind and consciousness enter into this? Because it's very clear that it does. We just don't have the tools or the understanding yet to be able to write the equations for this, as they were.
Edgar, are you a believer now in the multiverse, that there are more than one universe?
Well, it depends on what you want to, how you describe that. I think we have a lot to learn about cosmology. I'm not convinced, as are some of the others, astronomers and astrophysicists and cosmologists are starting to challenge the Big Bang as the way things came into being. I don't think that is the right answer. I think we're on the track of new answers of how matter arose and arises out of the quantum zero-point energy field and being able to codify that in a better way. So the future is there, and I think we're still on the track of it, but we're just not on a sustainable path, and it's catching up with us very quickly. You know, we're at peak oil, we're destroying our environment. All of these issues of sustainability are very vital right now, and we better pay attention to them.
You know, we've been doing some mind consciousness experiments, Edgar, on the program with some pretty remarkable success, to the point where I always was a believer, but I'm more convinced now than ever that collectively, when people set their minds for common good, they can change events. They can alter events.
Of course. We've done that over and over again. When we get enough people thinking in the same vein, we have a powerful collective effect, absolutely.
We've moved hurricanes. We've pushed them down from category fives to ones. Meteorologists were, there was a couple of years ago we did one that was heading, of course, toward Louisiana, not Katrina. And meteorologists said, we've never seen a hurricane drop in force so fast. And it was right around that period where we did our mind experiment to slow it down.
Yes. We're quite familiar with these techniques.
How do you feel now about NASA? If I can move on to something else for just a second.
NASA has a mission. It has much that it needs to be doing, and it will do it slowly. We have to get the entrepreneurs of our world moving in that direction. But first of all, we got to start solving this problem of sustainability and doing it with the proper respect for public service and the proper respect for the greater good. You know, the central message in all of this is service to the greater good is really the most satisfying and the only truly satisfying career. That when we're working to make it a better world, that's what's important. And as long as NASA is pursuing space travel and our understood space technologies for the purpose of making the world a better place to live and our technologies more useful to us, that's an appropriate approach. If we're doing it to continue our warlike behaviors and our approaches to life like that, then it's a wrong path.
Do you think we're going to lose any distance to the Chinese, for example, who want to put a man on the moon? They want to establish a base. The Russians are talking about it now. And that's another interesting story. I find it fascinating where they're talking about establishing a base on the moon in 15 years or so. And still, they haven't gone to the moon. And they were ahead of us for a moment in the space race.
Well, I think there's much to say for the way, for our ingenuity and the way we go about things. No doubt about that. But I think, yes, the Chinese are quite capable of now doing it. They have learned from us. They have their own approach to things. And they're people to be reckoned with. Let's just hope that they don't have to learn the message, help us learn the message the hard way of using warlike behaviors in order to accomplish a goal.
What's your greatest fear, Edgar?
My greatest fear is that we will ignore this problem, this opportunity that we have in front of us to resolve the sustainability issue and keep this civilization going, and that we will find ourselves engaging in a nuclear holocaust that may be the end of everything.
You say you're not concerned about the asteroid that's going to hit us. It's us, ourselves.
Well, that's a possibility. Fortunately, there's people like Rusty Schweikert, one of our colleagues from Apollo 9, who's very interested in that and working very hard on it. So we all have something to do with it in this larger scheme of things.
When people still hear the word astronaut, do they get excited about that?
Some people do. That is true. They certainly do.
And I know. We all wanted to be astronauts when we were kids. You did it.
Well, I was very fortunate and placed myself in the right channel at the right time.
Well, you had the right stuff, Edgar.
Thank you, sir. But, see, it all happened quickly. It all happened when I was coming back from the Korean War. Actually, I was aboard a carrier in 1957, completing my tour of duty, my second tour of duty in the Pacific, when Sputnik went up. And I realized that humans would be right behind robot spacecraft, and that sounded like something interesting to do. So that changed my, I was coming back to be a test pilot. And
finish that story, Edgar, when we come back. I'd love to hear how you got named to be an astronaut. It's his final hour. We started him early, so hang around. Edgar Mitchell's with us, and your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And with our guest, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, we're going to take your phone calls, and we'll also find out how he became an astronaut when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Edgar Mitchell will take your phone calls. Edgar, let's finish the story on how you became an astronaut.
Okay, well, surely. I was on my way back from duty in the Pacific aboard a carrier to test pilot duty. I'd been out two tours and went back to test pilot duty. Sputnik went up at that point. I realized humans would be right behind robot craft. And that seemed, even though I wasn't really planning on a military career nor an aviation career, it seemed that going to space might be a place to do. So I reoriented my career, got more education, including a PhD, and was eventually selected into the Apollo program in 1966.
Was it a tough program when you were in it? I mean, were there people who dropped out, they just couldn't take it?
Well, I think the selection process was quite good, and by and large, we had a few people drop out for their own reasons, and I don't quite know the circumstances of that. But once you were selected and went to work, we all worked pretty hard, that is true. And we lost a few people along the way for a number of different reasons, like all humans. But if you stayed in there and worked hard, you were going to eventually get to fly.
Did you have family? Were you married when you went to the moon?
Yes, I had a wife and two daughters at that time, and of course they're all grown up now and have their own families, and I have wonderful children and wonderful grandchildren. I have additional children, adopted children, so all together I have six children and nine grandchildren adopted in bio, and they're all wonderful human beings.
Good for you. Do you remember the goodbye with the wife, the moment you walked out of the door and had to go to Kennedy, Cape Canaveral?
I will say that the wonderful ladies of the space program endured a great deal, and they endured it well, and they were a credit to us, to the nation, and to womanhood at the way they had to put up with all sorts of inconveniences and being away from home. As it turns out, in those days, as I recall the numbers, for NASA, after a few years, the divorce rate exceeded that of medical doctors, which was the high point.
Yeah.
And, because of such an arduous, everyone was so devoted to getting the job done. It was a very strenuous and arduous assignment.
How long did you have to train from the moment they named you as an astronaut until the Apollo 14 mission?
Well, I entered in 1966 with a group that came in 66. We had technical assignments and training and technical assignments to accomplish. And then I flew in January of 1971, so that was 5 years later.
And then retired from the Navy.
I retired after the flight. Well, after I had backed up Apollo 16 and the final three flights of the Apollo program were canceled. So we didn't fly the last three, which I had hoped to be another flight on. But no one got to get on walk on the moon twice. And the public was rather... I said, okay, ho-hum, been there, done that, and we canceled. The program was canceled at that point.
Did you want to? You wanted to go back, though?
Oh, well, of course. As a scientist, we had just barely begun the chore of exploring the moon and starting to get some better information about it and understanding our neighbor here. But that's when it all ended. And all of us would have liked to have continued that, and certainly the scientists wanted to continue exploring the moon, and we didn't do that.
What did you find to be one of the most fascinating things on the moon? I mean, was it the rock, the craters, the pocket of craters? Was there any one thing that stood out?
Well, to me, it's just nature itself, understanding nature, how all of this came to be, how matter has organized itself. And, of course, from following my experience in space and coming back, to understand, okay, why are we conscious at all? That the stories of ourselves that we passed down for centuries and generations, maybe we should relook at that in the light of modern knowledge and the fact that we are now a spacefaring civilization.
When you were standing on the moon, Edgar, how deep is the dust into your shoes, into your boots?
Not bad. We prepared in the early days, you know, we had the big foot pads on the lunar lander just in case it was soft and we would sink in. But a couple of inches was about the furthest, unless you were right on the edge of a fresh crater. A couple of inches on the surface, or sometimes just a half an inch, depending upon how rocky it was at that point.
Were you careful that you didn't hit what could have been a sinkhole, for example?
We didn't notice anything like that. There wasn't anything obvious.
How quiet, aside from you talking to Alan Shepard, how quiet is it out there?
Well, since there's virtually no sound whatsoever, since there's no air to carry sound.
But you didn't hear anything hit the planet or anything like that?
The only thing we did hear in the spacecraft itself, we occasionally heard something like a micrometeorite hitting the spacecraft, a little ping sort of sound, but that wasn't very frequent. We can't prove this, but it seemed like that was probably some very small cosmic particle or solar particle.
There were little extraterrestrials on the moon throwing rocks at you.
Right, something like that.
How many days were you on the moon, Edgar?
Well, we were there 2 days. We were 34 hours, actually, total from landing to launch on our mission, including two periods outside of almost 5 hours apiece. So we were walking on the surface almost 10 hours, and on the moon totally in the spacecraft and out a total of 34 hours.
Was it strange sleeping and waking up knowing you were on the moon?
Yes, it was. We had the little problem. We landed a little bit on a slope, and a few degrees slope. The spacecraft was kind of tilted, and that gave you the feeling that we were tipping over. Now, we knew we weren't, but you had to look out the window ever so often and make sure, hey, is this thing still stable? So it was not a good night's sleep that we had. However, it was adequate. We did sleep and got our job done.
Do you remember leaving the surface of the moon? What kind of feeling is that?
Well,
was there like incredible thrust?
I'm sorry?
Was there incredible thrust? What's it feel like?
I didn't get that word.
The thrust as the rocket took off.
No, that wasn't so much, because the moon's gravitation is, of course, 1/6 that here on Earth.
Right.
So you didn't need that much thrust to get up into orbit. But our spacecraft was a sporty little vehicle, as all of them were, and so it jumped right off of there pretty nicely.
And off you went.
Off we went.
Let's take some calls. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on the air with Dr. Edgar Mitchell on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is me.
Yeah.
I want to say thank you to both of you, and I'm just amazed I'm even speaking with you. I wanted to ask the doctor, if you were on, say you were on your deathbed, God forbid you don't, but and your child was there, not all of humanity, just your child, what would be the most important thing you'd want to pass on to them?
Well, it depends on what was the condition at that time. But if it was where we are right now, if we're in time soon, I would be saying working toward the service to the greater good, the service to humankind, and to preserve, making our civilization sustainable, which is what I work at every day right now.
God bless you. And I have to say, I'd hate to be your wife having to sit there and watch you take off into space.
The women,
must have been terrifying.
They did. They were wonderful. And it was difficult for them. That is true.
Oh, sure was. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. Hi. Hello.
Oh, am I on?
Yes, you sure are. Gotcha.
Yes. I wanted to ask Edgar about something about the materialization experiences he had with Uri Geller at Stanford Research Institute. You know, without wanting to discount the possibility that those were genuine cases of materialization, wondering if Edgar has considered the possibility that there was trickery involved there, possibly that Yuri was subjected to as well, and maybe others. I've read that SRI was connected with the CIA and various other intelligence organizations.
I'll answer your question right off the bat, because we had some very competent people there, including all of the scientists and some who were very well-trained magicians and very well-trained in these types of spook activities. And the answer is no. It was all very bona fide.
All right, thanks.
All sorts of precautions were taken.
Wild card line, your turn. Where are you calling from?
Oh, this is Bill from Long Island.
Hi, Bill. Thank you.
Mr. Mitchell, I have two questions. One is, what is energy? Every definition ends up sort of being circular or redundant. And if you say it's the capacity for doing work, it turns out that work is defined in terms of a force, and then force in terms of energy. And I know we can describe the properties associated with it, like velocity and temperature, but science can't seem to define it in terms of something more basic than itself. And my other question is that NASA has come out and said not only is the Earth heating up, but all the planets in our solar system. I saw a panel of scientists that said we're heading down to the gravitational plane of the black hole. And as we approach it around 212, or possibly 10 years later, we're definitely going to go into a pole shift. And they say it has proof that it happened three times already in the past. I'd like to hear your comments on that, sir.
Well, first of all, I did not get the first word. Was the gentleman asking about entropy? Is that the word?
Energy. Wanted to know what your take was on just what is energy.
Oh, okay. That's a good question, because no one really knows what energy is. It's action principle that causes things to happen. And we can write equations for it and how it relates to other things. But what is it? I don't have the faintest idea, and neither does anyone else. Now, I know that you cited some very far-out speculations on cosmological speculations, and no one, some of these far-out ones are, I don't think, very credible. However, there is a lot that we simply don't know about the way the universe is put together, and we're learning more every day, but we're still just barely out of the woods. We're very juvenile and still uneducated, unknowledgeable species. Hopefully, if we don't get ourselves killed off through our own misfortune and stupidities, that give us another century or so, we'll have a lot better handle on how this universe is put together.
And what do you think, though, Edgar, about this universal warming, apparently, that might be
okay,
going?
Well, there's not any doubt, but what I personally made a trip to Antarctica just this year to talk with naturalists there. There is no question but what we're undergoing climate change. And there may certainly be a natural portion of it. We can't do much about that. What we can do is what we're contributing to it. And that's the only thing we can really change at this point. And we better darn well take a look at what we're doing and our contribution to it, because it's becoming very serious. And I would urge all of our listeners to take a look at the new movie just put out by Leo DiCaprio called The 11th Hour. It's just come out. I saw it just recently. Right on target, and we need to pay attention.
Wild Card Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Stephen from Los Angeles.
Hey, Stephen. Thank you.
First, I'd like to express how much respect I have for your guest. The astronauts, when I was growing up in my generation, were just the greatest of men. And your credibility is such that you made a statement that really floored me. You said, I believe, that the guardians of the reverse engineering of alien technology were the ones that Eisenhower referred to as the military-industrial complex. Is that what you said?
That is what many people interpret Eisenhower to have meant, is to that the military-industrial complex and embodied in new technologies, and in particularly warlike technologies, and for warlike purposes, was the thing to be concerned about. And I believe that to be true.
Do you think that that group was the beginning of a shadow government?
I won't say a shadow government, but certainly a group that has technologies and that has been very much involved continuously in the so-called UFO cover-up and misinformation and disinformation that's come out of that.
I've come to realize recently how subtle and how pervasive the disinformation program has been.
Oh, yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and good questions there, Stephen. Wild card line, you're up. You're on with Dr. Mitchell on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful. We're all well.
I'm Scott from Barrington, Rhode Island. I just had a quick comment to make to Mr. Mitchell, and then I'll let you go. I know as a child when I was growing up, I just turned 50 this year, and as a child growing up, I was a firm believer of the space program, and there wasn't anything that I didn't watch on TV. I watched Neil Armstrong, place his feet on the moon, and I watched all the other Apollo missions. And I sent a letter to Alan Shepard years ago, and I actually got a response back from him. And I wanted to know what I could do to become an astronaut. Of course, my dreams were then as they are now to be an astronaut. But his words, and I don't have the letter in front of me, was, put as much faith as you can in whatever you want to accomplish, and your dreams will come true. And I've tried to follow that with myself and also with my kids. And as I was going through my papers the other day, and I happened to come across the letter from Alan Shepard, and I showed it to my son and my daughter, I said, this is amazing that, you know, I have this to show you, that just follow your stars and shoot for the stars and just go for whatever you want to go for and just don't give up. And the only comment that I wanted to make is that the many hours that I have spent reading and watching you on TV and just watching the astronauts, I just want you to know that the many hours that I've had, I'm very proud of the fact of our space program and our government and the astronauts for giving me the dreams and the realization that if we shoot for the stars, we can get what we want.
Thank you very much. And that's what many of us say all the time when we're asked those questions. Follow your passion. Do the best you can, get educated, and go for it, and that's what you should do.
There you have it, Edgar. And, you know, when you, do you get recognized much?
Beg your pardon?
Do you get recognized much when you're on the streets?
Yes, I do. I used to more when I very deliberately try to stay out of the public eye, but occasionally I get recognized when I'm walking down the streets of New York. It has happened.
Well, you are an American hero, Edgar. No doubt about it. Stay with us. We'll be back with Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Edgar, what's your take on the shuttle? Do you think they should be mothballed or repaired, or what's your views?
Well, it's really a safety question. If I'm not involved in the day-to-day operation and looking at them. But we still need that truck in the space as long as they are functional and safe to fly. We've been having increasing problems with them. Not being close to it, I would hesitate to make a decision, make a judgment. But we do need the space presence, and we don't have the replacement vehicle yet. I'd hate to see us stop activities continues altogether till we get the right vehicle. I know it's already in work, but we still need this vehicle as long as it'll service.
How about the International Space Station? Do you see that as being worthwhile at all?
Of course. It is a part of our presence in space. There's work going on there that's appropriate. If we're going to continue to move toward our destiny of using space as the next frontier, which it should be, just as the first Phoenicians used their frail boats to start exploring the Mediterranean, and the South Sea Islanders in their dugout started exploring the Great Pacific. We need to continue doing this. We're destined, I believe, to go further, and we're not going to do it without the proper equipment.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Wildcard line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Tom, and I'm from Corning, California.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for calling.
And I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener. First of all, I want to start off by saying I'm very honored to get to speak with somebody of such a stature as Mr. Mitchell. My question is have you heard anything about the aerogel and whether or not you know if they've considered using that as a type of protective shielding for, like, the space station or the shuttlecraft against micrometeors or radiation, stuff like that?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that technology.
Aerogel. Yeah, that's supposed to be the latest. I don't know, Tom, if it'll really be implemented or not, but they're kicking it around. Okay, thanks for the call. Wildcard line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George.
Yes, sir.
Pleasure to speak with you. Good morning, Commander. It's nice to be able to speak to you, too. I have a real short question, and my question is this, sir. Would there be any kind of prints, I don't care if it was crawling, any kind of little prints that would make us believe that there possibly could be life on the moon? And I'll take my car, I'll call off the air, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Okay, so anything out there, Edgar, that would have led you or anybody else to believe
that? Nothing
that
I'm aware of.
Nothing.
It just simply doesn't have the necessary ingredients for life to have formed there at all, even though there may be some on Mars at that point from that ancient time, but that's even problematic. But certainly I know of no evidence at all of any standing that would suggest a life on the moon.
You didn't see any little worm marks or anything like
nothing,
that, huh?
No, not a thing.
Nothing unusual. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning. Rick in Toronto on 640.
Hi, Rick.
Dr. Mitchell, how much air was in each backpack in terms of time, and how many backpacks were there in the module?
Well, we only had one each. We didn't have any spares. You just replenished your air supply and water supply consumables when you went back into the spacecraft, from the spacecraft to reservoir. We had roughly, on our mission, 5 hours available with just a tiny bit of reserve on that, just a few minutes. So 5 hours was our limit, and we programmed our EVAs to 4.5 hours, and we routinely got an extension for another almost 20 minutes or so. So we were right at the
Yeah, cut it pretty close, Edgar, didn't you?
It was cutting it pretty close, that's true.
Well, okay, I guess you answered his question. First-time caller line. Hi there, you're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, this is Joel from Brooklyn. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call. I have a question for either one of you to answer. Could you guys explain the parallel universe to me?
The what, please?
Well, it all depends if there is a parallel universe or not, Joe. I will take a stab at that, Edgar, if you do not want to.
Well, of course, parallel is a theoretical concept, but there's universes that, and I'm not quite sure how you would define one of them, because we use universe to mean all it is. But if there are systems of galaxies and astronomical structures that are totally independent of what we would call a universe, that I guess you could call that a parallel universe.
Some physicists are believing more now than ever that there are parallel universes, that they may echo this universe. Maybe there's another talk show going on right now there with both of us, Edgar. Who knows?
Well, I agree that is one of the theoretical constructs that's going around as a result of the many-worlds interpretation in quantum mechanics. And I do not doubt that there are billions and billions and many, many star system galaxies. I don't know whether it's appropriate to call them another universe or not. That remains for the future to determine. I personally don't go that route.
Edgar, do you believe that in the future we will have time travel?
No, I do not. I think that what we're talking about here is a holdover from Newtonian times, and that the that the major processes in the universe at the macro scale level are all nonlinear, irreversible processes, the ones that are really germane to our existence. And I think that this time symmetry that's still still prevalent in some of quantum physics work is simply got to go away in due course.
Next up, Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
This is Shannon from Austin, Texas.
Hey, Shannon. Go ahead.
Dr. Mitchell, I have come upon some information regarding the fact that there is, in fact, a replacement vehicle already in use, making routine trips to the International Space Station. It takes off like a plane. Both the Air Force space program and the Russian space program have this technology and have been using it for years. Do you have any knowledge of that?
No, I have no knowledge of that. If that's true, I don't believe that's true, but there are a lot of things I don't know of, so.
Well, I gained this information from a friend of mine who just recently retired from the Air Force and was heavily involved in some very top-secret flights. So,
what did he describe? What kind of craft is it?
Well, it's large enough to it takes off like a plane and can go directly into low Earth orbit, just like the space station and just like the shuttle does. And it's large enough to be able to pick up all of the astronauts in the event of, well, like on our last flight, we had the busted tile. If there was some need to, they could have been pulled off of the space shuttle right then and there and brought back down to Earth. But they would have had to come up with some kind of a cover story as to how they got down.
Where does this craft land when it comes back?
Typically out in the desert, just like all the other, like all the other military stuff that takes off. He said that the Russians also use the same thing to get their cosmonauts off the space station.
I think that's just total nonsense. Sorry.
You don't believe it? Then,
I don't believe it for one instant. Now, I will go so far to say it is quite possible that some of the so-called UFO sightings of recent years may be homegrown stuff, but I'm pretty sure that there's not an unknown vehicle associated with both the Soviets and ourselves that are not aware, not in the public domain. I don't believe that's true.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Greg from Urbana, Illinois.
Hi, Greg.
Hey, listen, Georgia, and Ed, I was just wondering, once and for all, maybe you could answer, how far did Alan's golf ball go?
Okay, that's simple enough. There's pictures to show it. His golf ball is out there about 50 feet or so in a near crater, and my javelin is about 5 or 6 inches further than the golf ball, and we have pictures of that. It's nice to say it went miles and miles, and I asked Alan to, after each time it got a little bit further of miles and miles and then miles and miles and miles and add a few more miles, I said, I think miles and miles is quite enough, and I pulled up the picture. It's about 50 feet out there in the crater.
And he must have been in one of the world's biggest sand traps, huh?
That's exactly right.
Let's go to our first time.
It's pretty hard to hit a golf ball, though, in a pressure suit with one swinging with one hand instead of two.
Yep. If you, because I noticed how you had those hops, but could you run in that suit on the moon at all?
Well, run, you could make some fast strides and kind of bounce along. But each one of us learned to find a gait and a way of moving that was comfortable for us. And it was a bunny hop or a kind of a bouncing stride, kind of like walking on. You can practice on a trampoline. That's about as good a simulation as you can get here on Earth.
When you came back, were your legs wobbly?
No. No, not at all. The only thing, if you don't exercise enough
coming back. You may be a little weak, and it takes a day or two to get over it. But we're in pretty good shape.
I mean, you were gone for what? It was a 9-day mission, wasn't it?
9 days, 1 minute, and some 40 seconds.
What about weight loss? Did you lose any weight?
We were one of the first crews where they really were concerned about that. And so we had to stuff food a little bit to keep the docs happy. But I think as I recall, our weight was pretty close to where we launched.
Well, that's pretty good. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air. Hi there. Go ahead.
Who, me? Jonathan?
Yes, sir.
Jonathan Glimpsnyder, Frederick, Maryland.
Okay.
Am I on?
Yeah, I believe you are.
Okay. Okay, great, great. Hey, I'm glad I got through to you guys. Dr. Mitchell, George. Okay. Hey, I want to talk to you just for a second here. I'd like to talk to you for like a couple hours about the phenomena with Uri Geller, the many different phenomena. That everything pertaining to Uri seems to me to be on the, what do you want to call it, on the metaphysical side, inanimate, dead objects pertaining to anything that had to do with the bending of spoons, anything, deportation and the whole bit. But I want to tell just to you and everybody listening now, there are people truly on this earth now that have made a contact with the higher kingdom or what people call heaven that do have phenomenal gifts and abilities. I myself as one, and there are others. We are the living proof.
What do you do with this gift?
I'm a telepath. I can communicate to whole cities of people. I can tell you this. I'm in Frederick, Maryland right now. I am one of them that is the proof that when we do touch the other side of a kingdom that we call the creator or whatever,
right,
we are given abilities. These abilities are the proof and the truth, the kingdom of God.
Well, what kind of telepathy do you practice, Sir John?
Telepathy, I am a communicator. I have what would be known as the voice like John the Baptist had, to be able to talk to people off in the distance, instruct them, give them education, intelligence, or whatever, etc. I've had this for 32 years.
Well, I got to tell you, I don't doubt the fact that there are some people on this planet that have these kinds of abilities. I mean, we practice it with our own intuitiveness, Edgar, and everything else. Whether he is or not, I don't know, but I'm sure some people could do it, don't you?
Oh, yes. I've studied many, many telepaths and people with exceptional gifts, as far as I know, at the moment. Even though we can't absolutely describe these perfectly, we're getting pretty close at this point in time.
Let's go west of the Rockies. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hi. Kat from Lava Hot Springs, Idaho.
Okay.
Good evening, George and Dr. Mitchell. You almost answered my question. I needed to know if you had any health effects from going out into space.
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand the question.
She said, did you have any health effects going out into space?
Oh, health effects. No, as far as we know, we're still monitoring in a longevity study. And
Are you still part of a study at this point?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Been going on forever. And as far as I know, we're still kind of the epitome of healthy specimens.
Part of the argument of those who say we didn't go to the moon, that you had to go through the Van Allen belt, the radiation belt, and there's no way you could have survived it. How do you answer that one?
Well, all I can say is we're here.
Still alive and kicking.
Yeah.
Let's take another caller. Wild card line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, what a treat to have Edward Mitchell on air, a true patriot there. Anyway,
he is indeed.
You know what? It's sort of strange that you're saying again that everything in the military isn't that's available to public domain. You misspoke there because the SR-71 is flying around for 15 years without the public knowledge of knowing about that. So there's a lot of things in the military. I've worked as a contractor building military stuff, and I won't go into any details.
Well, he didn't say there weren't experimental aircraft that we don't know about. He said that the one that is going off to the International Space Station doesn't exist.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. I could understand that. Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds fine. Okay. Anyway, I was just wondering, there's one of the world's greatest psychic/remote viewers named Ingo Swine. He wrote a book called Penetration. It's, you could buy it on eBay for about $300 or $400. It's a soft cover magazine, basically not really a book. But he wrote in that magazine that's so well sought after, he remote viewed the moon. And this world-class psychic that's connected to the CIA and the U.S. military, he's so good. He actually saw and placed in this book, believe it or not, factories. Okay, factories of some sort of biological robots or some sort of non-human existence on that planet, the planet Moon, manufacturing something. And he put that in his book, and he's been criticized a lot by it, and the government actually gave him a lot of help from putting out that book. That's why it's so sought after. It wasn't reprinted again. And I was wondering, what do you think about Ingo Swann and his story about possibly an intelligent life form or something there building maybe human souls or something? He said something about the human soul was being manufactured there.
That they're stored out there and stuff. Go ahead. We've got a minute left, Edgar. Go ahead.
I know Ingo, and he's a very, very fine, sensitive, has great intuitions. I think that one's way a very far stretch and way off the mark. I don't think that's quite correct.
Though there could be some structures
on the
moon.
Is evidence. We don't have evidence for that.
That's what it all comes down to. It really does. And, you know, if there are structures on the moon, as some people believe, well, I'd like to see some more pictures.
Yeah,
wouldn't
we
you?
We just have to have some more evidence for it. That's true.
What was, very quickly, the strangest thing you and Alan saw on the moon?
Well, I think the strangest thing we saw on the moon was the moon itself. Nobody's ever been to that location, and looking at that and studying the geology, we were the first team to start to do real experimental work on the moon and to do the first geological trek up Cone Crater. So I would have to say, in direct response to your question, where we were itself was the strangest thing.
Just the moon. Edgar, thank you so much for being on the program.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
Yeah, always. And Edgar's website, edmitchellapollo14.com. Go take a look at it. Go take a look at some of his work as well.